with Pretoria to produce a nuclear-tipped missile for South Africa. It said South Africa's Overberg testing range, near the town of Arniston, was built to Israeli specifications. Citing a CIA document, it said the first missile flight of the Jerusalem-Pretoria alliance was on July 5, when a rocket flew 900 miles toward Antarctica. In exchange for the technology, NBC said, Israel gets the use of test facilities there, and a continuous supply of enriched uranium for its nuclear warheads. It's all lies, said Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Shami. But both countries are known to have nuclear weapons capabilities. And a US official with intimate knowledge of the subject told Newsweek that, the Israel-South Africa missile partnership couldn't be closer. The official said, we know everything, names, dates, everything. The missile project involves technology from Israel's Jericho 2B missile, an intermediate-range weapon of the type that Washington and Moscow have agreed to eliminate. Israel used a Jericho as the first two stages of a rocket called Shavit, Comet, which launched a satellite into orbit last year. American experts estimate that the Jericho 2B could hurl a one-ton warhead more than 1,700 miles. The timing is further complicated by friction between Washington and Jerusalem. The two allies are at loggerheads on a number of issues, notably Shami's reluctance to implement his own proposal for elections on the occupied West Bank. Having pushed and cajoled the Arabs into agreement, the administration now discovers, in the words of one senior US official, that Shami can't say yes to his own plan. The implied threat to Israel's military aid from the US, which amounts to a vital $1.8 billion a year, may have been designed to put new pressure on Israel. Despite Prime Minister Shami's statement that the report above quoted was all lies, the Pentagon on November 15, 1989, confirmed it as true. If, and when, another war comes to the Middle East, there are few things that can be predicted. One thing, however, we can be assured of: Israel will never accept defeat. When the Israelis say that never again will they be the only victim, they mean it. The end will come not as with the zealots of Masada, but as with Samson pulling down the pillars of the temple. When the Arab oil fields are in ruins, when enough cities have been vaporized, when the casualties are in the millions, the Jews of Israel will not be among the survivors. They will fight hopelessly to the death. Chapter 14: A Plan for Peace. For those who have tried to find the road to peace in the Middle East, it has been a treacherous journey, inevitably ending in bitter disappointment. The perilous road as a result of these failures in the many good faith efforts to bring peace to the Middle East, the idea has gained credence that the Israeli-Palestinian deadlock defies solution, much like North Ireland. As a result, a certain attitude of hopelessness has begun to pervade any discussion of the Middle East crisis. To adopt this attitude, however, is to fall victim to the Likud strategy, which is to convince the world that there is no solution except Israel's status quo. Under the guise of seeking peace, the Likud has spent most of its time and effort during the past 13 years planting landmines and booby traps along the road to peace. They have cleverly led peace seekers up blind alleys and into Israeli lobby ambushes. Most of the problems encountered in the search for peace have not been real, they have been contrived. The biggest obstacle to peace has simply been relentless Likud sabotage. To divert attention from itself as the main roadblock to peace, and to further discourage genuine peace efforts, the Likud has fostered the view that the issues involved in the Palestinian situation are enormously complex, the strategy being that, if they can discourage and frustrate peace efforts to the point where everyone gives up, they have won their primary objective. At this writing, this strategy is becoming dangerously close to success. It would be well, of course, if the Israeli-Palestinian crisis could be locked away and forgotten about. Unfortunately, long before the conflict reaches the North Island stage, it is more likely to have exploded in fireballs and mushroom clouds, perhaps taking a sizable part of the Middle East with it. The Bush administration, after Secretary of State Baker's initial strong and courageous grasp of the situation, and his forceful comments on the Greater Israel theme, many people took heart. Recently, however, it has been rumored that the administration is already wearying of the challenge. In an article published in the Jerusalem Post of September 23, 1989, the Bush administration's Middle East policy is discussed. It is pointed out in the article, entitled "Why Bush is in No Hurry to Take the Plunge," that President Bush and Secretary Baker are politicians, and, therefore, appreciate the special place that Israel has carved out for itself in the American political scene. The following are further excerpts from the article. For the most part, Bush, Baker and their colleagues regard it as a very risky, even no-win situation. Thus, those people in Israel and the Arab world who are hoping for an active and high-level American mediatory role are in for a sorry disappointment. Defense Minister Yitzhak Rabin and Jordan's Crown Prince Hassan both emerged from meetings with Bush, Baker and other U.S. officials in recent weeks reportedly upset by the administration's reluctance to get too deeply involved in the peace process. Barring some major development, Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak and Finance Minister Shimon Peres, among other Middle Eastern leaders due to visit Washington, will similarly be disappointed by the administration's passivity. Beyond the widespread sense in Washington that the Middle East is hopeless, there are also other more pressing problems right now on the American agenda, including the war against drugs, the economy, and the superpower relationship. Most observers here agree that there are only two ways that the U.S. is going to get deeply involved in the Middle East. The first will be if there is some sort of urgent crisis involving either hostages or actual hostilities. Short of that kind of emergency, the President and the Secretary of State will want to wait on the sidelines. Administration officials, despite this gloomy assessment, will continue to go through the diplomatic motions. They will continue to explore Israel's plan for Palestinian elections in the West Bank and Gaza Strip. They will focus on Egypt's 10-point proposal to implement those elections. There will be numerous meetings with Arab and Israeli leaders. But right now, this administration has no real stomach for undertaking the tough kind of decisions, the dogged hard work, and the political risks necessary to achieve progress. Emphasis supplied. In essence, the Jerusalem Post is telling us that President Bush and Secretary Baker have already been intimidated by the Israeli lobby, which they now understand has carved out a special place in the American political scene. As a result, the Post is almost gleeful in reporting the widespread sense in Washington is that the Middle East situation is hopeless. The President and Secretary of State want to wait on the sidelines. They do not want to get too deeply involved in the peace process. The fact that the Israeli lobby has already discouraged Secretary Baker within a few months of his maiden speech on the Middle East is more than a cause for alarm. It is a warning of disaster. If the Jerusalem Post article is even close to the truth, it is a liquid triumph, a major victory for the Israeli lobby and a great loss for the Israeli people. As we have seen, the chief goals of the Israeli lobby and its client, the liquid, are 1. To stifle and block any efforts by American Jews to exert any influence on liquid policies. 2. To keep the US from doing anything in the Middle East that the liquid doesn't approve of. For the US to be passive, or stand by or not want to get involved, as just quoted from the Jerusalem Post, is a liquid prayer answered. In chapter 12, we have made an effort to identify and deal with the issues which lie at the root of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. It is apparent that the issues are quite clear. The problem is that the positions of the parties with respect to the issues are irreconcilable. Just how complex is the issue of the future of the West Bank and Gaza? A single bone tossed at two hungry pit bulls does not create a complex issue. The solution may be painful to the dogs, but the issue is clear and non-negotiable. Even Shammy, in a lucid moment, states it plainly: what's to negotiate? They think the land is theirs, we think it's ours. There is nothing at issue in the Middle East that remotely compares in complexity with the problems that must be solved in, for example, negotiating a reduction of conventional forces in Europe, or in the strategic arms talks. These involve matters so technical and esoteric that only a relatively few people in the world can understand them in all of their ramifications. The problems are so involved and convoluted that, with the best of intentions, they take years to negotiate. The complexity argument is simply another liquid smokescreen. The liquid success lies in the fact that rational minds have difficulty dealing with irrational concepts. This is what